Once you get the clap one time, that's all you need.
Yep.
You learn your lesson.
Now and then no more clap. I can click to my heart's content after that.
Sonata. Drummer. Come on, you.
Well, rise and shine, everybody. You are listening to the Drunken UX Podcast, and we are kicking off season 2 over here on, well, I don't know, in my office. I was going to say, you know, out here in podcast land. Whatever. I'm your host, Michael Feenan, and with me on the other microphone is your friend and mine, the late, great Aaron Hill.
I'm not. Well, I am always late. Hello. We need to sample the air horn sound. Right at the beginning.
Why do you hate me so much? We worked so hard.
I hear that a lot.
To get so far into this show and become popular, and you just want to drive everybody away. Oh my lord!
Maybe like a vuvuzela.
I don't know. What? Venezuela.
No. Vuvuzela. That was the thing when at the Olympics the one year. Everyone had one, you like whip it around in the air, and it sounds like droning bees.
I hate to tell you this, but I'm wearing pants. I can't do that right now. It's a whole
look
other
it up.
Show.
Vuvuzela.
I'm not going to do that. Folks, if you want to follow along with us all the places, be sure to check us out on Facebook or Twitter. We are at /DrunkenUX. On Instagram at /DrunkenUXPodcast. Or you can hop into Slack with us and have a chat anytime, give us some thoughts, suggest a show topic or whatever the case may be. Go to drunkenux.com/Slack. You can track us down any of the ways that you feel like.
Indeed.
It's Drunken UX podcast time. That means only one other thing.
I bought a bottle of... So, okay, I have to backpedal here. The Tanqueray is like my favorite gin. It's like a family choice thing. And I always usually get just the regular, you know, ring-of-the-mill Tanqueray green bottle stuff. But I picked up a bottle of the Tanqueray number 10 just to try it out. And I got to say, it does taste different. I was expecting it to be tastes different because I paid more for it. But it actually does taste a bit cleaner and crisper. So I've got that in it with some tonic. It's green and red. Seasonal.
I feel like that is the sort of gin I should probably try because I don't like gin, but I don't like gin, and so I have no real desire to hunt out like a better gin. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's I like it. I mean, I like the juniper flavor. Like, can throws people off sometimes, and I suppose maybe that's like an acquired taste, like learning to like coffee or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I think where you are in your life the first time you experience it is a determining factor.
I will say, though, like, if you drink it by itself, it's, I mean, you can, but if you balance it with a good, like, bit of tonic, like, the two of them, they cancel the bitterness out of each other. So, anyways, I know you are drinking something special, and we should tell everyone.
Yes, I ended the season special. I'm starting the season special. Every year, a buddy and I, we go in together and we go buy like a really expensive bottle of scotch to enjoy amongst ourselves. And so I'm breaking it out to start the show. We picked up a bottle of the Glenmorangie Signet, which is basically Glenmorangie's top line bottling. It is a gorgeous Highland single malt. The bottle is beautiful. The box is beautiful. The cork on this thing, you pull the cork out of the bottle and here,
it's like 5 pounds, right?
We'll start it this way. We'll do a Hannah Hart here. Just go boop boop. Thump, the stopper thump. On it is like cast steel or something. It's cork.
Wow.
But the top of it is solid metal and it's hefty. But it is a beautiful, rich. It's a very sweet Highland malt. It's got a very chocolatey, sort of almost coffee kind of finish to it. Oddly enough, I tried it with some water. Not as good with water. Water actually, I think, makes it a little worse, which I didn't expect and is usually a little water helps open up your scotch, helps, you know, light, give you access to some of the lighter flavors and stuff that are in it. But okay, with this, it just didn't. It just made it taste more alcohol-y.
How do they get the richness? Is it like aged in like port barrels or something? Or
so with Glenmorangie, they have a whole line. Like their normal bottling is a 10-year bottling. It's very good. It's mm-hmm. it's very mellow. It's a nice, accessible Highland Scotch. They've got a mm-hmm. series of three more: the Quinturban, the La Santa, and mm-hmm. the Nectar d'Or, which are all aged in different types of casks. So
okay,
the Quinturban, I believe, is done in port casks. I always okay. get Quinturban and La Santa are port and sherry, and I can never remember which one is which off the top of my head.
Okay.
But imparting different, you know, like that deep red wine, that sweet wine flavor. Nectar d'Or is aged in Sauterne? Sauterne? It's a wine word that I think it's French. I don't speak okay. French. But it's a beautiful light. Whereas like the La Santa is a very strong, rich, in your face kind of flavor. The Nectar d'Or is this beautiful, delicate, sweet flavor. And so they use these different approaches. The Signet is like their top end, and it's a blend from two different whiskeys okay. they do. And they use two different types of barley. And I don't, at this point, I'm reading for anybody at home. I don't know this off the top of my head. It's made from a single estate Cadbull variety and a malted chocolate barley. And I don't know what a Cadbull estate barley is. All I know is that when you put the two together, it makes fucking incredible scotch.
Excellent.
This the only thing that makes me sad about it is the kind of thing you enjoy a glass of, and then you put the bottle up for a while because
right,
it's
right.
not. I split the cost of this bottle, so. but I thought it was a beautiful way to kick off the show for the season, and I'll probably switch to something throughout the end of it. But that's where I'm at, because only the best nice. For our listeners. Although I'm going to drink it on your behalf and smile the whole time.
That is a nice looking color right there.
It's beautiful. I don't think it's artificially colored.
Yeah, no, that's like gorgeous. That's like a nice light brown.
There are some like Dalmore, and I love Dalmore. Don't get me wrong. But like Dalmore actually darkens their scotch. They color it. And I think like Dalmore is one of them too, depending on where they're bottled and whatnot. They don't have to disclose that they color it.
That seems like, why would you, I don't know. It seems silly to
Because do. A beautiful dark scotch just looks really nice, you know? So,
but that seems like if you're going to have that color that like you should earn it, you know, like, or I don't know. It just seems.
Welcome whatever. To marketing.
Yeah.
Oh, let's see here. Well, I want to talk about some stuff because we are kicking things off, and I think what better way to get back into the future than to start looking at the future? And if you run by the show notes, we'll have a link there to a video that's on a page, or maybe we'll just put the video there. How about we just do that? We'll just embed the video in the show notes.
Yeah,
we can do that. We build websites. Right? We know how to do that.
Yeah. Well, they're embedding it. It's like a YouTube video, right?
Yeah, it's just a YouTube video.
Yeah, so we'll totally just do the same thing.
We'll save you a click. That. You're welcome.
That Nielsen Norman Group.
Yeah, it's so Nielsen Norman Group. Jacob Nielsen put out a video. It's just a little 2-minute video, so it's a quick watch. It's nothing like super crazy or in depth. And he's answering the question: will people be more tech savvy in 10 years? And I thought it's just a neat little question, and he goes into it very lightly, and the summary of it is basically no, they won't be. And I agreed, but I thought the rationale was interesting on it, and I thought that we could explain a little bit as to why that is, because it plays into UI, it plays into user experience design, it plays into human computer interaction, right. all of this stuff that we're doing and building relies on understanding how people react to it, right?
I disagree with him somewhat, but I want to hear your thoughts on this first.
So my argument comes back to this idea of the Model T. And I tell the story, and actually I've even got it worked in a little bit later in the show. This idea that if cars never advanced, if all we did was drive Model Ts and all we had, then everybody would be a mechanic, because the understanding of that car would become a piece of our own culture that, you know, is handed down, and there would be no secrets about it. There would be no myth, you know, behind how the Model T works.
That was kind of what happened with the Volkswagen, right? Like with the Beetle and the bus and the Rabbit and everything.
Yeah.
Those were built to be accessible and repairable by normal people. So, yeah.
But the thing about it is that's not what happened, right? Cars advanced. They became more complicated. We discovered things like automatic transmissions and air conditioning and radios. The technology advanced, but the drivers really haven't.
Right.
You know, driving a vehicle still amounts to the same process. Now, if you've ever driven a Model T, you know driving a Model T is nothing like driving a modern car. But
yeah,
it didn't take long for us, you know, about 1927, 28 in there, we finally kind of fell into this modality of like gas or you know, brake, clutch, gas.
Right.
Right. No, clutch, brake, gas. Right. Yeah, that's what it is.
Sorry. I mean...
Even I don't know anymore. And that has carried through, though, all the way up to today. And, you know, people can drive cars and we understand them, but we don't understand what's going on underneath them. And there are still...
We don't need to. We don't... Right.
But there are also still incredibly bad drivers out there, too. Like, you would think that after a century of driving cars, humans would be really good at it, but we aren't.
Well, I mean, that's sort of, you don't have to know how the car works to know how to operate it.
Right. In a basic way.
Yeah.
And that's what, but that's what we see.
And maybe that's what he's saying.
Yeah, that's, too, that is sort of what they're getting at, which is people can use websites. We can use a computer mostly. You know, people are more capable than they used to be in that area, certainly. But the underlying technology has advanced more quickly than our ability to use it as a general populace is kind of the point there.
I suppose.
All
right.
We can't, in 10 years, the person that is using the website in 10 years is the same person that's using it today. And their understanding and ability is not going to change dramatically in that time span. You know, their knowledge, their muscle memory and things like that will be relatively the same. All the way down, you know, think about other technologies, maybe not cars, let's say VCRs. From VCRs to DVD players, we continued the same basic experience design in them, from the remotes to play buttons, rewind. You know, we still have this concept of the rewind button. Well, DVDs don't rewind, but we had this stick to that method and that tune, because that's what people knew and understood. So there you go. That's user experience in action. You're laughing, but you know I'm right.
No, I'm laughing at the... I knew someone... Okay. I knew someone whose mom got a DVD player, and after having a VCR for a very long time, and the first time she rented a DVD from the local video rental place, she asked if you had to rewind the DVD. My friend told her yes. So she did.
That's just mean.
I know. That's why I laughed.
Well, we broke Aaron, so that's at least that we got that. All right, going
so I'm gonna give you a counterpoint to
so
that.
So you disagree.
So I do agree with most of the things you just said, and I think that like the operator versus mechanic aspect is definitely a thing. However, okay, so 20 years ago, I was in college, and we had a 100 level class called PCs and Their Uses, which the first lesson in that was how to turn it on. So that was a 100 level college level class about how to turn on a computer. And then 10 years ago, we have YouTube. Like, YouTube started existing, right? 2008, right?
YouTube, 2006, I believe.
Okay. Well, roughly 2000. Yeah. So, like, 10 years ago, we have YouTube. And then now, like school curricula, like my my son's middle school curriculum, they have a regular class that teaches the kids how to do code through the San Francisco coding program, which we mentioned in the previous episode or two episodes ago. And I think that learning some of the mechanics, to just extend that analogy, is becoming a little more widespread. And I think that we can make some more assumptions about our user base. Although I guess it also depends on what Jacob Nielsen, like what users, what demographics he's referring to. Because
he was talking, you know, in a very broad general sense.
Okay. Well, in 10 years, kids who are 8 years old right now are going to be adults. They'll be 18. They'll be going into college. And I guarantee that, well, I can't guarantee, but I have a very strong suspicion that those kids in 10 years from now will have far more tech savviness than they do, you know, now or 10 years ago or 20 years ago. I mean, partly because the ability to transfer knowledge is so much faster and easier and more accessible. You have Khan Academy, you have YouTube, you have all these different online e-learning courses that middle schoolers and high schoolers can go and access on their own for free. And so, like, the ability to learn stuff about tech and about what is going on under the hood, so to speak, is going to be a lot easier.
I think, though, like what he's arguing is not so much that, you know, the world in 10 years won't have some radical differences, because I agree. I think, you know, everything you say is right, that kids are learning things at different times, you know, in different ways than what you and I certainly did and whatnot. That world is not going to be radically different. And the way in which that is accomplished won't be. Because
won't it 10 years from now? I mean, like 10 years from now, think about it. We already have the capability to do VR using Oculus Rift and the Vive, right? Yeah. And the other one.
I have PSVR now. I got it for Christmas. I gave it to my wife for Christmas. I happen to have used it a lot.
Oops. Well, like, so, like, these are already, like, consumer-level electronics. In 10 years, I imagine it will be, like, what smartphones are now, where it's just sort of something that, or, like, what flat-screen TVs are. It just becomes more ubiquitous. And so the way we interface with computers might be completely different. I don't know that, I guess maybe I'm circling back to what your conclusion you had, was, like, maybe the tech savviness is irrelevant. Like, do we need to design things any differently?
Right. Here's the perfect analogy, because it's one that goes back, I don't know, what, 50 years?
Mm-hmm.
The keyboard.
Mm.
We've had the ability to not have keyboards for a decade and a half.
Mm-hmm.
Laser project something onto a flat surface. Voice to text. If nothing else, better keyboard designs. And yet, by and large, the keyboard has never changed.
We're still using QWERTY.
Yeah, I mean, everything, you know, mine is a little curved with a cutout in the middle, and they got rid of the cord, but it's still keyboard.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, there's this grounded nature, and in terms of learning and things like that, and I had a fun with a talk on this several years back about, you know, the way people learn and how it applied to online education at universities. And the thing is, technology doesn't change the way people learn. It changes how they can learn and what they can learn. But the way in which we learn as a species doesn't flex with that. And there is certainly a top. That. Like, yes, we can get access to all of the stuff on YouTube and Wikipedia and all of these, and Khan Academy and all these places.
Right.
But there is an upper limit to how much you can consume and process and retain. No bearing on technology at all. And I think that's where this idea of, in the end, our tech savviness does have an upper threshold a little bit, because we can't go out and completely revolutionize things in 10 years, because the people, you have to cycle out generations for that to actually happen.
Yeah. I think that we definitely saw a huge acceleration in tech savviness between 1998 and 2008, for example. you know, computer literacy in general became a lot more prevalent because the internet became more prevalent and because there was more of a reason for people to want to learn how to use computers. And I think the same thing in the last 10 years, too.
And think about how part of that happened, too. Like, think about early iOS design and the way it was influenced by skeuomorphism.
Right.
And, you know, part of the way it succeeded was by making its UI translate what we knew in the analog.
You know, honestly, like flipping this on its head, I think that if we as developers and designers are really like doing our job and pushing the envelope on this, I think that users should become less tech savvy in 10 years. Because they're, well, they should have, in the same way that, you know, going back to the Volkswagen analogy, in the 60s, you know, people, there was a reason to learn how to, like, you know, fix your own carburetor or like take care of minor issues with your, you know, oil changing and small spark plug changes and all that other stuff. But you don't have to do that anymore. Like, because the cars are more resilient and, well, also more complicated, but we just don't have to do it.
Yeah, but when they fail,
we know less about mechanics.
They fail spectacularly.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and look at Tesla. You know, Tesla is a good example of that, right? That, you know,
they literally explode.
By and large, you know, they're super great. They do a ton of stuff. Yeah. You know, their driver autopilot stuff is incredibly good. But boy, when it fails, it fails. That kind of thing. So you let us know what you think. What do you think tech savviness will look like in 10 years? I'd be interested to hear. I love this sort of future think stuff and, you know, predicting what things will be like. Because, you know, the more they change, the more they stay the same. And I think we're always surprised sometimes in how much Star Trek we have and yet how little of it we have all at the same time.
You know, you mentioned Star Trek. Like, if you look at the bridge there, how many of those people do you think would know how to, like, fix the holodeck if something went wrong? You know, just pretty much the engineering team, right? Like, everyone else is going to be like,
Barclay could do it. LaForge, of course. Data. Wes. I think Wes could pull it off.
Maybe. Yeah.
King Will.
Because reasons.
Anyway. So today's topic, kicking off the season, speaking of looking ahead to an extent, we want to tackle the question, and we are not the first to get here. We won't be the last, but it's a fun conversation nonetheless, of should you be taking the time to learn jQuery? And I think this is, you know, it's a take on the, you know, the X is dead, long live X type story. And we all hate it.
I regularly see those on Quora.com. And it's always like, is blank dead? The ones I get notified for are usually like, is Ruby dead or is Rails dead? Or worse, now that Rails is dead, what will... And it's like, the fucker. Like,
and it's understandable because, you know, the technology has a life cycle. The things we use, and this will come up again later, but Flash is a good example of something that came up, you know, felt super useful. You know, people thought that this was the way of the web. You know, Flash was going to be how, you know, the interaction layer took place. And then it didn't.
But yet people are still learning and using C and C++. So
it has use outside of the web, though.
But I just mean, like, as far as technology goes, like, just because something is old doesn't mean that it's going to become obsolete. Just because something is new doesn't mean it's going to be around forever.
Right, yeah. So with jQuery, and here's your little bit of a history lesson, especially for folks who maybe aren't as familiar with it. jQuery came out. It's very much, you know, like what we would use as a CSS or responsive framework today. You know, these JavaScript libraries, they were this way to take and abstract and simplify techniques that we used in JavaScript to help. This is going to sound fluffy, but to democratize functionality. jQuery was sort of the start of this idea of, let's take this mysterious thing called JavaScript and make it easy and make it do a lot of stuff for people. And it was really, I think it was one of the first big ones. Now, they may have gotten beaten to the punch by some of them, but they definitely got the gas, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so they took and combined all of these things in the one place. You know, kind of like the way a library does. so with now all of a sudden, you could go include one file, and with this one thing, you could do everything from episode number one, season two, and I already can't talk. DOM manipulation, you could do Ajax, you could do animations, you could do interactions, you could do all of this stuff, and you only needed one thing to do it. You weren't including a right. different file for everything. It was one deal that you could go get and download that was kept up to date. And that was a full 12 years ago now. Wow. Not old enough to vote, so it's getting there.
The same year as YouTube then. Wow.
I think so, yeah.
I didn't realize they were contemporary. That's interesting.
Everything happened in 2006.
Clearly.
Just everything.
Actually, yeah.
If you were to like draw out sort of the ages of internet development, I think right there mm-hmm. between that 2006 to 2008 period was, a very big transitional period into mm-hmm. the sort of web we have now.
Yeah.
And ultimately, jQuery won the war. It's the one that's here. It's the one we use. There are tons of them, though, that were out there.
I remembered the name that I was trying to think of earlier, but before the show we were talking about this, Scriptaculous.
Yeah.
Using Prototype. That was the one I was trying to think of.
And I remember the domain. It was like script.acula.us.
Yes. Scriptaculous. Yeah, yeah. So it's still up.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I don't think it's probably not gone. Most of them aren't. Mootools. Mootools is also still around. Now, of course, YUI, the Yahoo UI library, is, I think, a little dead, defunct because of Yahoo. But
right.
YUI was one. XJS was another, which I think it's actually still around, too. And
I remember that one.
Yeah, it had this very application way of thinking about
its yeah.
UI framework and interactions that just very much didn't age well.
Yeah.
And a lot of these, you know, some of them were kind of competitors. Like I throw out there JQ Touch. JQ Touch was the JavaScript library that was designed to emulate iOS for mobile devices.
Right. And then there was jQuery Mobile, JQ Mobile.
Same thing.
Yeah.
So it started as JQ Touch and was, you know, it needed jQuery, but it was its own thing maintained by somebody entirely different, and then jQuery absorbed it and just called it jQuery Mobile.
Okay. I remember using jQuery Mobile for this is prior to us using Bootstrap, for a site that we had to have mobile access for.
Yeah, I launched.
It was pretty good.
I launched State's very first mobile website using jQuery Mobile.
Yeah,
I think if I remember right, we were the first university in Kansas to have a mobile website.
Nice.
And I'm pretty proud of that. And it was good. It looked nice. It worked well. It was what it was for the time. It, you know, nice. Today it would be terrible, but you know, it followed that same pattern of, you know, iOS at that point, because we're talking 2008, 2009, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
The iPhone came out in 07. We're still like mm-hmm. super early in this idea of a mobile web. And so everybody's answer to mobile development was just make it look like it does on iOS.
Right.
Because there was no competition. Apple, there was nobody at that point. Android didn't exist, you know? You had BlackBerry.
Right. Are they still around? BlackBerry?
Yeah, they just released that phone that, like, was awful.
Which one?
I think it was just a new BlackBerry.
Yeah.
it was bad. That's all I remember.
Yeah.
So at any rate, though, jQuery, you know, they come through, you've got all these guys, and that's not to say now, XJS wasn't great, but Scriptaculous was a relatively good library.
It was Dojo, too. Was another one.
Dojo's another one. Dojo, I would group in with what we're going to be talking about, because Dojo also had a lot of back-end stuff. Like, one of Dojo's big selling things was your ability to take Java classes from a server-side piece. And expose them to JavaScript and be able to use them through Dojo. So it made it kind of a front-end/back-end type thing.
Did you have to use, like, struts in the back-end or Tomcat or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you had that, that Tomcat or, you know, any kind of VM type, or not VM, but Java.
Java thing.
The thing, the word that I'm looking for that isn't coming out of my mouth.
Java VM, JVM?
JVM, yeah, literally Java VM. And I couldn't, yeah. I could not get the acronym JVM to come out of my mouth. So there you go. But God, we are having a rough start to this season. Let's go. But that was the thing. All of these competitors, they were all front end because that's the only way we thought about web development at that point. All of these resources were designed to help you strictly on the front end.
Right.
And like I say, Scriptaculous was good. MooTools was good. And jQuery just had the force of will and the robustness.
Why did they win? Like was it, what was the watershed moment for them? Was it they got adopted by some big players arbitrarily and then it just sort of rolled out from there?
I don't have an answer. My speculation to that would be A, WordPress.
Mm.
WordPress started including it as a default part of their backend and through the registered scripts area. And jQuery UI. Remember, jQuery had that really, and it may still be out there, I'm sure. jQuery UI was an extra package that you could load that had all of these just extra elements, you know, stuff you didn't always need, like, you know, calendar pickers and other animations and tabs.
And you had to select them from a big, like, checklist.
Right.
Which things do you want? Yeah.
And you could roll your own jQuery that way. It would give you a customized download with just those bits and pieces that you needed.
That was I do remember doing that. That was a cool feature that they had.
It got cumbersome after, you know, like from a maintenance standpoint, because then anytime they updated, you had to redo your stuff. But those things combined, I think, gave it the desirability and market share that just kept it going, basically.
Yeah.
I
ask that mainly because, you know, if we think about, you know, we're talking about the future of jQuery, and I think that if we understand how jQuery won, we might also understand how it might eventually be supplanted by something else. And like what things to look for on that front.
Take that deep thinking and get off my show. This is not the place for that. You are not drinking enough yet, sir.
I do need to refill.
You know what? What it comes down to is jQuery just had a really great kitchen sink product. I mean, anything you needed to do with JavaScript, jQuery basically was able to empower, whether through the core library or the UI framework, plus the plugin framework, which, you know, that's a whole other part of the
that was probably a big part of it, too, is the extensibility.
Being able to just drop in, you had something custom, you could just write a plugin and drop it in there and tie it straight into your jQuery setup. So, and I'm sure I didn't use Scriptaculous enough. A very, very cursory level is all I ever used it. I'm sure they probably had something along those lines, but, you know, jQuery really marketed that piece of it.
Well, Scriptaculous is built off the prototype framework.
Right.
And the prototype framework was very comparable. I think prototype and jQuery were like the last holdouts. I remember seeing those two, because prototype was the one I was learning. And then it was like, all right, I guess I'll learn jQuery. Ugh.
So today, jQuery is basically used by 74% of websites.
Wow.
So
in the show notes we have a link to an article with a graph on this, but it's a power law distribution. So like jQuery like 74%, but then like the next one is like a fraction of that.
Yeah, so and that's a lot. Like when you think about what is on all websites, there aren't a lot of things out there, you know, like when we talk about WordPress, WordPress is the CMS that drives the internet. They still only have 30% market share. And yet here we are with jQuery out there dominating 74% of websites because it's just there, right? Everything just includes it at this point.
Actually, on one of the show note links, it says that as of 2017, jQuery is 83% library distribution. jQuery UI is on 22%, Modernizer on 16%, Bootstrap on 13%, and then everything else is 11%, or it's 11, then 8%, and then 4%, and then onwards down.
Yeah, a lot of these numbers you take with a grain
of salt. MooTools has 1.8% still.
All of these things, you know, they're scraping websites, looking through archives, things like that, and trying to identify, you know, stuff in the code. So there's going to be, depending on which measurement tool you look at or whatever, you'll get different notes.
Yeah.
But the broad stroke is pretty much the same, though, which is that jQuery is everywhere. So, I mean, we're going to spoil the episode for you here real fast that should you learn jQuery, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to put some context to that here in a little bit, but to act like we shouldn't know how to use a library that's used on 3/4 of all websites, that's just a stupid thing to say.
Well, okay, so, like, when we say should you learn jQuery, it doesn't mean, like, should you learn jQuery to the point where you're writing your own extensions
right.
and where you're, like, doing really deep down stuff. Like, you can learn everything you need to know about jQuery in about a week.
Easily,
so,
yeah.
Yes, you should spend a week learning jQuery so that you're at least literate in it and can do basic stuff in it.
Yeah, that is a good point. That we aren't saying go out and be the guy, the go-to expert,
right?
But functional. You need to be functional,
like,
in it.
We're not saying to build your career on learning jQuery, but like you should, if you don't know jQuery, like expect you are going to have to learn it at some point. So it's maybe it's not should you learn jQuery, it's like, are you going to have to learn jQuery at some point? And the answer will definitely be yes.
Now, the funny thing is, in these tools and their breakdown, they also are able to pick out which versions of jQuery are in use, because usually every jQuery file has a version number included in a comment or in the file name. And they found that only 6.4% of websites had jQuery 3 and up on them. Which was real interesting, because it shows this this picture of what happens in a system like WordPress, let's say, where the sites update and, you know, when a minor release comes out, your CMS updates and you're just there. You know, things like jQuery don't do that. You have to manually go out there and make sure you're updating your libraries. And people don't do that, basically, is what that's telling you. And I don't know what, when you add in jQuery 2 to that, I don't know how high up that number goes, but it's not much. I mean,
the largest share of all jQuery versions as of 2017 is 1.12. So we're up to version 3. Version 1.12 has 21.37% share as of 2017.
It's like looking back and seeing IE.
Two major versions. Yeah, for real. Or IE6, right?
You know, the thing and the reason why, and to revisit this question of why did jQuery win the war, this is kind of why, too. You can still run a website on these old versions, still have that code out there, and it works perfectly well. It's a very functional, very resilient framework in that way, which is a credit to it and part of what makes it so useful. It's one of those, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, if your sites aren't going down because the latest version of Chrome came out, you know, if you're not throwing errors everywhere in your console, then most people don't even think about keeping up with something like that.
And really, you know, it's there's not a whole lot of, I don't want to say there's not innovation happening, but there isn't a lot of a need to add new stuff if you're not already using it. Right.
Right.
And if the one of the developers from jQuery has even said that in the newer versions, most of what they do is remove stuff. So they're taking things out, not adding new things. And so if you have a version that works for you and it doesn't cause you any problems, and there isn't a whole lot of security threat potential there because it's all front end, you know, like, why would you need to upgrade it all?
I mean, your biggest threat ultimately can come in the area of, you know, if you load it over a CDN, for instance.
Yeah.
And somebody happens to be able to poison the CDN or something like that. That's ultimately
right.
one of the biggest threats to not updating that kind of stuff. It is a very, and I don't want anybody to take that as advice to not worry about updating, because obviously that's terrible advice. But there is a certain resiliency there that, you can get away with a whole lot more, and it's just doesn't create the same kinds of, you know, the threat model is very different by not updating in those cases. And most of it, like you just said, is about efficiency. It's about refactoring, things like that. Then, and even I was sitting here trying to think of what was the last big thing jQuery took out, and I honestly can't tell you. because I don't, I'm not a change log hound for it, so I'm not like there reading every single thing.
I'm willing to bet that the majority of the reason people, like, you know, if people are using 1.12, you had Ajax and you had like basic UI effects, and those haven't changed much. So if that's all you needed it for, especially if all you needed it for is like basic Ajax stuff, jQuery is a nice wrapper for that. And I mean, it's just, if it's working for you, why change?
Well, and you mentioned the power law distribution of just sites using jQuery. Mm-hmm. I bet, you know, if you could look at that in terms of how they were using it, I think you would see something similar in that most sites are probably using it for a slideshow.
Right.
And it turns into a real long tail from there in terms of like
right.
the number of people who are using jQuery and developing super dynamic complex websites with it and running all of these different, you know, animations and things like that. Like, that list is pretty short in the grand scheme.
Or they're installing it as an afterthought because the thing that they actually wanted, such as the slideshow you mentioned, whatever it may be, just happens to also have jQuery with it. And they didn't bother to think, I'm going to download jQuery. They just thought like, oh, these are the files I need to put in this folder, and then I need to do this line of code, and then the thing just works. Yay! Yeah.
Now, part of the reason why I think this discussion has changed and is, I think we're seeing it more anyway, and whether that's you go to Quora or whatever, you're watching Twitter, these places, this idea that the war itself has changed. jQuery mm-hmm. was originally in this war with other front-end frameworks. These were front-end frameworks that were trying to do the same things in most cases. Mm-hmm. They filled the same, we had this discussion before, niche? Is that the one I should say?
Nietzsche?
I'm going to take a page from your book. I'm just going to call it Nietzsche.
Nietzsche.
And that's just the way, I mean, my own pronunciation.
Oh, that is now how I too will also pronounce it. Good. It will now be Nietzsche forever.
Now jQuery is facing this pushback from the new frameworks. And these are, right. you know, call them the node bunch, whether that's React or Angular or Vue, these JavaScript frameworks, they're still JavaScript frameworks. And they mm-hmm. absolutely take the place of a lot of jQuery's functionality, especially when it comes to data handling and DOM manipulation and things like that. But,
right.
and I'm saying this with a word of hedging, they are mm-hmm. largely designed to be front-end and back-end components mm-hmm. because they're all built around this idea of much more MVC-focused development. And you see them, the reason, or the places where you've seen these come up a lot is with folks building web apps or single-page apps or things like that, as opposed to a website, a blog.
Right.
And I think that makes a big difference, though it doesn't change the fact that people keep lumping them all together.
Yeah. I mean, in those people's defense, though, the speed at which the JavaScript community moves makes move fast, break stuff even say, whoa, wait a minute.
The thing here is, when you look at these frameworks, it's one of those, like, they aren't exclusive to each other. You could build a React application that absolutely uses jQuery. Like, these things are not mutually exclusive, though I think most folks would kind of turn their nose up at that thought. But it doesn't mean you can't do it. You just probably shouldn't.
I mean, they wouldn't occupy the same namespace, so I guess you could.
Yeah.
Like, everything in jQuery is all under either jQuery or $ namespace, and so I don't know much React, but I know some, and of what I know, I don't think they would collide.
And out of...
But I don't know, I also don't know why you would do that, though.
Yeah.
Because I think React has all of that functionality baked
in. Like I say, overlap is part of what makes it a little weird. Vue is probably the closest, because you can absolutely use Vue as a front-end only JavaScript library. Again, most people don't. Because, again, most people I think that understand and are interested in learning these things are people that are building something with a server-side component. I may be wrong on that. I'm totally speaking just, you know, out of my sphere of influence and what I've seen and heard. But
sure,
they definitely, I think, occupy a different resource space. And the thing that makes me feel weird about it is, even if we say, if we distill this down to Vue, and visit the show notes, we'll have some articles there about, you know, what the differences between Vue and jQuery are, and those mm-hmm. will go more into that. But at the end of the day, making the argument that you shouldn't learn jQuery because you should learn Vue instead is sort of bizarre to me, because you're basically saying, don't learn that library, learn this library.
Learn this library.
And ultimately, you're trading off. You're not net gaining. Yeah. You're not getting ahead of anything, because jQuery itself isn't necessarily broken, and it's not...
Well, the only thing you're gaining is a smaller community of support, right? Like, jQuery's been around for over a decade, and
I know that folks will say that Vue is simpler, and that you can do things quicker in it, and that's entirely true, depending on your use case.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not true in every use case, and I think there is still a higher barrier to entry for those than what you have with jQuery, because even at the most basic levels, most tutorials and, like you're saying, you know, your community support is not necessarily geared towards a front-end only thought process, which is kind of what jQuery does.
Right.
So let's switch gears. I realize I say "so" a lot when I'm changing gears. I need to fix that. Taking notes here. All that being said, there are legitimate reasons to not use jQuery, and we need to go over some of those before we talk about why you should learn it. Because if you fall into some of these categories, you may honestly not, you know, think about not using it. But I want to dispel one of the big myths, which is that jQuery is too big. We've seen this with CSS, we see it with JavaScript, you know, this argument that you need to make your page smaller and make your payload as tiny as possible. And that's a great goal, but people act like jQuery is, you know, this 300, 400 kilobyte package that takes up a ton of room. And it will if you're using the uncompressed, you know, full shebang. But the minified version is only 85 kilobytes.
Yeah, didn't we mention in an episode about, actually, this is going way back. Season 1, episode, like, 2 or 3, we're talking about embedded video. And then about how, you know, the average size of the average website is hundreds of kilobytes. I'm sure that jQuery has a notable impact on that, or a notable portion of that, but 85 kilobytes is nothing.
Yeah. And you can offset that by optimizing one of your images that you maybe didn't catch, you know?
Right. I mean, you probably have images that are bigger than 85 kilobytes.
And if you are serving from, you know, most any server that's using gzip, that size, that 85 kilobyte minified file, is only about 28 mm-hmm. kilobytes gzipped.
Yeah.
So jQuery, if there are reasons to not use jQuery, but arguing that it's a space issue, I don't think is valid.
Yeah.
Unless you are in some situation where you really are trying to run as absolutely lean as humanly possible.
If that's a situation, though, then you should be writing, but completely rolling your own JavaScript.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, if you're trading that off for Vue, then, because here's the thing, if you want to use Vue, go for it. Same size.
Yeah. Actually, I mean, I think if you are of the presence of mind to realize I need this to be running as lean as possible with a small load time as possible, you probably already know whether or not you should be using jQuery.
Right.
Yeah.
The size argument, you know, I get it. You can make it, but I just, yeah, if it's just a trade off issue, or you honestly think that 85 kilobytes is going to make or break you, then I think you have other questions, I guess, to tackle at that point. So one area where it is a perfectly valid reason to think about not using jQuery is if you're doing JavaScript development in a test driven environment.
Right.
Because jQuery creates a dependency tree that can influence, you know, the way you approach testing. So,
true.
For instance, right now, I've sort of been embracing Cypress. It's very straightforward. Okay. It's very easy. It does client level integration testing. So, you know, it's literally testing the way things are being put out to the user. And that works pretty seamlessly because
okay.
it's working through the browser. And so you're getting, you're getting that same level of experience at that point.
Is Cypress similar to like Selenium or one of those?
Yes. The answer is yes. Okay. I have not used Selenium to any degree. So I couldn't.
But it's that kind of
thing. Yeah, yeah. You write your automated tests and like it'll go through. You can have it click stuff and it uses the same assertion library, Chai assertions.
Okay.
So if you use a test framework and you're familiar with Chai, it's the same, mm-hmm. Such and such expects length 3, whatever. I sure. see a menu. I expect to see these links that have, YouTube listed or something,
Sure.
But that all works really well because there isn't a lot that it has to do on its own. It's interpreting.
Right.
As opposed to like unit level testing.
Right.
So in those situations, and I can't for the life of me remember the test suite we were looking at originally. But I was trying to make it work with some of the code we wrote, which was jQuery based. And I could not for the life of me in our build process get it to know that jQuery existed because the jQuery was included client side. It wasn't included in the build process.
So it wasn't executing right. I see.
And because unit tests generally only look at a very small piece of your code and it right. can be very blind to all of the other things out of necessity because you're, in theory, you're trying to make very small pieces that function.
Right.
But that makes jQuery very difficult in those environments, I think.
We on the Rails side of things, I use the Capybara gem, which does it's similar to Selenium. It emulates a user interacting with a browser, and the Chrome driver library, or what should we call it? It's a binary. You grab it from Google's thing.
V8.
It's a kind of. I mean, I don't know what it's using, but it's using Chromium Engine, and it's great. Like we've used a couple over the years. We've used like the WebKit one. That's the default that comes with Capybara. We've used Poltergeist, which uses PhantomJS as the JavaScript interpreter. And then, but Chrome driver is great though, and it has really good JavaScript support, and it handles a lot of the jQuery stuff pretty well. With every once in a while, you run into an issue with funny stuff, but generally though, it does a pretty good job.
Yeah.
So if you're doing Rails, you should be using Chrome driver. I think actually it's funny because even the makers of Poltergeist, the Poltergeist library, they've said like, we're no longer supporting this. You should use Chrome driver. It's better.
Everybody's abandoning ship for Chrome. But yeah, that idea also lends itself to this idea of if you are trying to write really portable code, it can be useful to not use jQuery. If you want your code to be very encapsulated and very functional on its own, then avoiding jQuery might be what you want to go after because that's going to give you that ability to write something that anybody can use and not have to worry about, have I installed the other libraries or do I have, jQuery yeah. UI on top of it and things like this. That,
right.
That can become cumbersome. And it's that same idea of the same reason why you unit test code is because you want very small, individually functional pieces of information. Mm-hmm. This is that same thought process, just without the testing piece. You want
right.
small, encapsulated, self-dependent code that doesn't have to bring in anything else. Because otherwise, what you end up with is a lot of people all including jQuery over and over and over again.
What could possibly go wrong?
That's part of why WordPress added in the script enqueuing stuff. Is because if three mm-hmm. different plugins all enqueue jQuery, it knows it only needs to fire at once. But
when I worked at Cornell, we had a kind of a Skunkworks not a library, but like a bunch of Skunkworks PHP we had written, and I wrote a subscriber pattern thing in PHP that did that where you would say this class or whatever depends on jQuery or whatever, these components. And then when the page rendered, it would look at, you would just take the unique set of dependencies and then load them. Because we kept having issues where, like, Jake Corey would vote it more than once.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's a... there, I think it was just a draft proposal for, like, the HTTP standard that had something along those lines where you could define in page what pieces of, like, a broader package you needed.
Oh, wow.
But that was quite a while back, that'd and it didn't cool. get very far, but it was neat, but nonetheless. There's one other reason why not to use it, and it's going to sound silly, but if you're avoiding learning native code. But that can be a thing.
Wait. But to clarify, by native code, you mean like just plain old JavaScript, yep. right? Okay.
Podges?
Podges?
Plain old Pogs? JavaScript.
Pogs. JavaScript spelled with a G.
And that's a Pojo joke for anybody that isn't as funny as me. the thing here is, you know, there are a lot of ways. jQuery was designed around this idea of trying to take all of this stuff that worked in different ways and had to be written multiple times for different browsers and make it into one thing that you could use and make that easy. And for a lot of people, that's good enough for whatever it is that they were writing. And if your goal is to do something quickly without care for the nuance, you just want it to work, which is a perfectly valid thing. You know, if you're more of a CSS person or designer,
right,
just writing, you know, header dot add class and, you know, add class active is a really simple, straightforward thing to do. You may not be benefited by taking the time to scrounge over, you know, like caniuse.com and figure out, you know, is all of this stuff supported? Where is it supported? Whatever. So there's definitely a value to that. And that's nothing to be ashamed of if that's, you know, if that's all you need and that's what gets you, you know, where you need to be.
On the flip side of that, though, jQuery is a nice safe haven for those of us that don't want to have to learn vanilla JavaScript. There's in the show notes, I'm putting a link to a lightning talk called Watt, W-A-T, that has, he starts off talking about Ruby, but he goes into talking about a bunch of really funny, weird oddities in JavaScript. So it's like 5 minutes long. It's totally worth the watch.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. I would say, you know, if your career is going to be in front-end development, like deep front-end development, that's not a good excuse.
Ooh. Yeah.
But if you're just visiting, so to speak,
yeah,
it's perfectly reasonable to say, you know what, I'm just going to do this the quick way. And that's one of the reasons why it is worth it. Because for a lot of people, jQuery is just like a comfortable set of training wheels. And if you can jump in and do some real quick prototyping in it, which is true with just about any framework. Most frameworks, if you know it well enough, you can prototype something quickly in. But you know, jQuery has a lot of support, a lot of examples out there, and you can get in and in a few lines, there is no denying the fact that in a lot of cases, you can do something in fewer lines of code in jQuery than if you had to write it out yourself.
This is not going to be an accessible analogy to most people, but for those of you that are Linux users, I kind of find it similar to like using Ubuntu versus using like ArchJS or one of those, Arch Linux or one of those, because I use Ubuntu because I don't want to have to mess with all that bullshit. I just want it to work.
Yeah.
I just want to have an OS that works. I don't have to think about it. I just want to do the thing on other stuff and not mess with operating
systems. You don't have to roll your own operating system.
Right. Arch Linux is way more powerful. I don't dispute that. But you also have to fuck with the operating system bullshit that I am not interested in.
Tell us how you really
feel.
So
if you have the... if you have the time for it, like, you know, you do you, boo, but I'm not there for it.
Well, and you know, that goes a long way too. You can't sometimes just jump into the deep end, and jQuery can be that way of just introducing simple concepts to a user to get them used to different syntaxes, you know, understand what a callback is and how it works and what it does. Yeah. What it takes as arguments and things like that, and you can ease into some of that.
Do they have the callbacks and like the promise thing in jQuery 1.2?
I
thought that was a relatively recent
version number wise. I couldn't tell you for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, that's one of those things that gets too detailed for my old brain.
I think the callbacks was version 2, and I think promises were in version
2. And for folks that don't know, like a promise is basically part of a code that tells another part of the code whether or not something happened.
Yeah.
So that it knows, you know, to expect something. It for asynchronous.
Right.
That's the phrase I was trying to dig out of my brain.
Is that also a closure? I always get that.
No, closure is a library, isn't it? Or no, it's a language.
No. Is it the closure is like the closure is like a block of code that you pass it.
I'm trying to be funny.
There's names.
I messed up my own joke though. Closure is an actual language. It's not a library. Oh, Michael.
I've been out of college too long.
Yeah, I know, right? So these things, they lead up to something though. So if you're using it to simplify concepts and introduce people, the next natural step is that learning jQuery as kind of a simple JavaScript can be that stepping stone to understanding actual native code solutions to things.
Yeah, definitely.
That's why jQuery existed. That was its whole purpose. If you can reach back, if you've been around long enough to know what it was like writing individual XML HTTP request code for Internet Explorer and for Chrome and Firefox, and each one handled it a little bit differently. You had to write it, you know, in a very particular way and check for the existence of things. And it was Ajax was a pain in the ass.
It was. I remember writing XHRs manually, and it was a pain in the ass.
jQuery is the reason Ajax succeeded, in my opinion. I don't think Ajax would have succeeded as a technology if jQuery had not saved it, basically. Because it came in and it just said, oh, you want to do something Ajax-y? Then just use the Ajax method and give us an endpoint and the data. And we'll handle all that different
stuff. Oh, man.
We'll figure out which browser it is, which syntax it needs. That was the watershed moment for when people looked at jQuery and went, oh, we need this.
If your use case allows you to use the load method of the Ajax portion of jQuery, oh man, that is so nice. Like $.load and then like the URL and the destination like node where it's going loaded and
Now amazing. It's worth noting that argument, you know, it's not as necessary as it used to be. jQuery isn't. Because things like that have normalized over the years. This need to have a library that deals with all the browser idiosyncrasies, you know, that piece of it is actually filing away. And that's one reason why these conversations come up. You still need to learn jQuery. Yeah. It's because the reason we did it and the need that was there that it was solving for isn't the same need that it was 10 years ago.
Right.
But that's okay. You don't need jQuery for it to be helpful.
So there's a link in the show notes for this comment on the jQuery GitHub where someone was asking, you know, what's the future of this library? Because, you know, looking at your commit history and your blog posts and other things, it's kind of like slowed down to almost like, you know, the pulse is very slow. And the one of the maintainers for jQuery pointed out that they are intentionally doing like less frequent releases because of a lot of things we've discussed already, you know, like having to upgrade, and also they're trying to remove things instead of add them. But he did say that they have roadmapped for probably version 4, quotes, a complete rewrite using next generation JavaScript. This in turn requires an update to our build system because we want to use ES 2015, which is ECMA 6, right?
ECMA script, yeah.
Yeah. We need to do this in a way that keeps the final size identical or smaller than the original. So they are actively maintaining it. It's not like this is a dead library or anything.
Well, I think of it like PHP, right? You know, everybody, anytime somebody steps up young and is, whether it's on Reddit or Stack Overflow or something, they ask, what language should I learn or should I learn PHP? And you always have this group of folks who are really quick to be like, PHP is a terrible language. It's a dead language. It's not. There's so much better stuff out there to go learn.
Well, two out of those three things are
it's,
right.
I mean, it's a ridiculous way to approach learning in general. Even if PHP was not like super active or anything, it still is the backbone of the internet at this point.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah,
entirely. And like you were saying, and we'll revisit this in a second, but this idea that you don't have to become an expert in it to have it be worth learning. You can learn it at a functional level and be fine. And that's I've seen that with PHP so many times. Folks saying you're wasting your time learning PHP. You know what? People said you were wasting your time learning Java 10 years ago, and guess where Java is today? All the same places it always was, because it has anchored itself into the industry. So looking ahead, and why the answer to the question of should you learn jQuery? Yes, is if we look ahead 5 to 10 years. Let's put that, and I'm not going to be picky. 5 years, 10 years, whatever. 10 years is probably good because it ties us back to the start of the show, but we aren't trying to put a button on it like that. I said it early. I'm going to say it again. jQuery isn't Flash.
Right.
And if you're scared of learning jQuery because you're worried about it failing, not failing, but going away, being outmoded the way Flash was, don't have that concern because it won't.
Flash required a lot more. Like, you could not learn Flash reasonably well in a week. Like, to use Flash in an effective way, it required so much onboarding with that. But jQuery, you can learn how to use it very functionally and probably at least 50% of your use cases in just a few hours.
Flash also, at its best, was riddled with serious problems. From bugs to accessibility issues to loading problems across the board. So the other thing, so we know jQuery isn't Flash. And if anybody wants to go deeper into that subject, I'm always happy to. I consider them very different technologies, and I think Flash failed for reasons that are unique to it, that don't apply to jQuery. That was a funnier joke than I intended it to be. Go me.
There's a lot
to unpack.
There's a lot bundled into that statement.
The other side of this is what the backbone is, that we're talking about is JavaScript, right? All of this, at the end of the day, it all comes back to just JavaScript. jQuery is just JavaScript. It's just JavaScript that has been written in a smart way, basically. What has happened is JavaScript is based on the ECMAScript standard, which has improved every year, and people hear this thrown around. And it's confusing, and it doesn't always make sense. As Aaron had just mentioned, if jQuery 4 moves ahead, they want to base it on what's called ES6. It used to be that JavaScript got very rare updates as a language, as as a subject matter. So what we had throughout all of the 2000s, basically, was the same JavaScript that we always had. In 2009. There was a huge update to JavaScript, and that was when we started this idea of, or no, I'm sorry, 2009 was the last relatively normal update to JavaScript.
Big one.
It was in 2015, hence the name ES2015, that they came out with this huge update to JavaScript, included.
Oh, that was ES6,
ES2015, ES6. Okay. We're same thing, just different for whatever. Because it was easier, right? They version ECMAScript is a versioned language like anything else. And we'd been on ES5 up to that point. And keep in mind, ES5 was what was available when jQuery came out.
Right.
So in 2015, by that point, jQuery's been out forever. And now ECMAScript comes out and says, oh, and by the way, here is a dump truck of new stuff you can start using now.
Right.
The problem had always been that even though JavaScript supported it, That didn't mean browsers supported it.
Right.
And that's where, you know, if you are getting into build processes and things like this, and you're hearing phrases like, you know, Babel, that's another one. Is it a long A or short A? I don't know. the Babel module, you know, when you are doing a build process and you are writing, when somebody says they are writing their JavaScript in ES 2015, and they're using Babel to transpile it, what they're basically saying is they're writing in modern JavaScript and using this library to take that, and it knows how to rewrite all of those pieces using more JavaScript to reproduce the functionality in different ways so that it will be backwards compatible. All of this to say, JavaScript itself is getting better every year. There is an ECMAScript update every year in June. That's an annual, it didn't used to be an annual release cycle until 2015. With that, jQuery's role definitely changes because it means JavaScript is capable of improving upon itself in a way that it couldn't when jQuery came about.
Right.
That said, it's still slow. And while ES 2015 has pretty good support across the board on a browser standpoint, ES 2018 doesn't. And there will always be some of that to deal with. And I'll be interested to see, you know, what jQuery does to kind of pivot. And it sounds like that's exactly what they want to do. They want to remain relevant and they want to, you know, figure out a way to fix these things and still provide value with jQuery 4. That'd be an interesting topic to maybe get a dev for, have a chat about. But at the end of the day with jQuery, and JavaScript, there's going to be a few articles in the show notes. For a lot of you, if you want to start writing jQuery-less JavaScript, you can easily reproduce a lot of its functionality now using native code.
Right.
And that can be more efficient in some cases. You can use just the pieces you need. Even if you want to use the same style selectors, there are ways to write a $ parentheses, ID label, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And have it behave the exact same way jQuery does, because that's all jQuery is doing. jQuery is just doing that in JavaScript. And so you could do that.
I would be really surprised if someone doesn't write like a jQuery Lite thing, which is just those it's like just document DOM manipulation and AJAX, and then that's it. And like jQuery Lite or whatever they would call it. And then to see if that rolls out to like all these places that are using jQuery, like 1.2 or whatever.
If you go to one of the links, it's called You Don't Need jQuery. It's from a user called Nefe. Here I am with not being able to pronounce stuff. But he's got all of these things that jQuery does, and they're native JavaScript analogs. And so you could take all of his code and just, you know, package it together and use the pieces you want. And that's basically what you would have is in JavaScript or jQuery Lite.
Yeah.
What we're going to need to do.
Cool.
And this is maybe more of a 5-year watch rather than a 10-year, is paying attention to what big players are doing. Because the big news this past year was that GitHub announced that they had completely removed jQuery from their code base.
Yeah, that's amazing.
That was a big move on their part.
Yeah.
And they'd been working towards it for a long time. They weren't trying to like turn the light switch off. They had been over time, you know, chewing it away and taking it out as they improved stuff.
Their Rails based. Yeah. What are they using for their front end then?
Native code. I think everything is native code for them.
Okay.
I don't think they're using no library at this point. And because there's an article in the show notes that is from the engineering blog at GitHub, and they go into all of this, like how they kind of strategically approach that, because that's a big undertaking. To say you're going to remove all dependency on a library. That's another reason why jQuery has held on so well, is because it's part of a lot of places' infrastructure. And
I mean, if anyone was going to do that, though, like GitHub is not surprising.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they go into depth, like how they approached it, why they did it, what value they're getting out of it. And a lot of it comes back to some of the stuff we've talked about, things like, you know, test-driven development and portable code and things like that, but also storytelling in code. being able to look at code and understand what it's doing without a bunch of comments and things like that. Mm-hmm. One of jQuery's strengths is also its weakness in that by abstracting a lot of stuff away, you remove context of what's happening.
That's a good point.
And yeah, it's, you know, if you're the only person working on something, that's fine. But if you're working on a team and people come and go or anything like that, it definitely changes the vernacular that you need to use when you're writing.
I don't want to deviate too much on this, but that's actually a really important thing that I've been discovering the past year or two, is that 9 times out of 10, I prefer code that's easy to read than code that's clever or even in some cases, like, fast. Like, if something is, like, you know, if it runs in 3 milliseconds with this particular version, or like the easier to read version runs in 4 or 5 milliseconds, like, I'll take the easier to read version most days. Because, you know, like, if you have to maintain that, you're talking about saving hours of time if something is easier to understand overall.
Right. The other big player that's going to be out there to watch is WordPress.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, they're doing React now, right?
Yeah, you know, it's that idea of, I brought you into this world, I can take you out of it. You know, they introduced jQuery to 30% of the web and have added it in there. And naturally, you know, themes are going to support it for ages beyond now. You know, WordPress isn't going to take it out of, like, the registered scripts or anything, but they could remove, just like GitHub has, they could remove all the dependencies in their framework now that they are moving towards React.
It wouldn't be a bad idea for them to.
I don't think it would be.
That would move more of the stuff in-house.
Yeah.
And create less. I think that would be smart on their part.
Well, and we were saying earlier, like, this idea of you can mix and match jQuery and React. That's a thing you can do, but most people wouldn't recommend it.
The maintainer from GitHub that I mentioned earlier, who's maintaining jQuery, I have another quote from him. He says, jQuery can and does get used alongside robust application building solutions like Angular and React/Redux, but its main usage probably still lies more within websites rather than web applications, if I can make that distinction. And I think that that's probably, you know, if the question for this episode was, should I use jQuery versus should I learn jQuery, then if you're doing like a basic website of some kind and not something that's framework based, then jQuery is probably a good consideration.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's absolutely the distinction, like with WordPress.
Mm-hmm.
A theme using jQuery is not the same as WordPress using jQuery. WordPress, the backend application, I think within 2 years, you will see it going exclusively React.
You know what, though? One of the reasons that WordPress is so nice is because both PHP and jQuery are relatively easy to pick up. I cannot say the same about React. React is not as easy to pick up as PHP and jQuery are.
Oh, yeah. No, it's
I'm saying this as someone who's trying to pick up React.
Yeah. It's a different learning curve. It very much is.
Yeah.
And because it takes that idea of what is JavaScript and turns it a little bit on its head, because it's using TypeScript and, you know, this other stuff that is a variation of ECMA standard. It's
a lot more pieces involved.
Yeah, the JavaScript landscape, like, if you want to have a fight with somebody about, you know, why JavaScript is a messy language, there are a lot of perfectly valid cases you can bring up there.
I think it would be likening, saying, like, learning PHP versus learning WordPress. Like, you can learn serviceable PHP very quickly. Learning WordPress is going to take a little bit more time, in the same way that, like, you can learn JavaScript and, by extension, jQuery quickly, but learning React is going to take a lot more time, just because you have to see more of the picture in order to actually use it.
Yeah. Well, there's a clock counting down on it.
Yeah.
I mean, the reality is jQuery, I think, does have a lifespan, like any technology does.
Sure.
And a lot of it's going to come down to exactly what you were just saying with React. React is a denser language. It's got a sharper learning curve. And the way we approach training new developers moving forward is going to say a lot about how quickly that clock counts down for jQuery. Because as of right now, there's a lot of safety sort of in that world.
But you know what, though? Even if all the maintainers on jQuery decided, you know what, we're done. We're not going to maintain this anymore. And no one else decided to pick up the mantle. You can still use it. Like,
oh yeah,
it still works. And it will probably still work 5 years from now. As long as you don't need anything too modern and complicated, like, it's probably fine.
The final thought that I'll throw out there is simply what we've been stressing, which is, at the end of the day, should you learn jQuery? Absolutely. Because at some point, you're going to have a project or a tool or an application or something that you need to maintain. And that something was going to be written by somebody else who used jQuery.
And stepping back from that even, you're a web developer. Get used to it. You're going to have to learn a shit ton of languages and about all kinds of different things, and you're going to have to learn the different levels of depth. So, yes, this should be something that's in your repertoire, whether or not you use it all the time.
Yeah. With that, sit back, take a second. We're going to take a break, and we're going to wrap things up. The Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. NewCloud is an industry-leading interactive map provider who has been building location-based solutions for organizations for a decade. Are you trying to find a simple solution to provide your users with an interactive map of your school, city, or business? Well, NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. They have a team of professional cartographers who specialize in map illustrations of many different styles and are ready to design an artistic rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all of your users' devices with responsive maps that are designed to scale and blend in seamlessly with your existing website. To request a demonstration or to view their portfolio, visit them online at nucloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux. Folks, thanks for listening to the Drunken UX Podcast. It's season two, baby!
Season two!
We've already lined up the first 3 months of shows, and we're going
to
be
recording. I had no idea we would be making a season two episode when we decided to do this a year ago.
That's his way of saying that he wants to quit, and I'm not going to let him.
What?
If anybody wants to apply for a co-host position, just email us at host@drunkenux.com. Folks, we got some exciting stuff coming up. We've got some new show concepts that we're going to be doing. We've got new topics that are going to be on the way, and all the things, all the special stuff. We're going to have fun with it. Got new episodes of Real Time Overview coming out with a new format. Build Process will be coming out in the middle of the month, as always, and all of those things. So we're happy that you've stuck around. We hope you have fun with us. And if you have anything, I guess let us know, right?
Yeah, connect with us on your favorite social platforms, be it Facebook or Twitter. You can find us at DrunkenUX, or you can find us at drunkenux.com/Slack. If that's your jam, I've got 11 Slack channels, or Slack sites? Slack instances?
Yes.
Yeah.
I don't know what they're called either.
Yeah. Yeah. And then also on the Insta Giggles. That's what you called it earlier, right? Insta Giggles?
I did no such thing. I would never call something an Insta Giggles.
The Instagrams.
That's how you get out on a list.
Instagram/DrunkenUX Podcast. Make sure you have that last bit on there. That's where we keep all the flavor.
Otherwise, gosh. I guess all I can tell you is the same thing I tell you all the time, because I enjoy it and it makes me laugh. But that's, folks, keep your personas close and your users closer. Welcome to season two. Bye-bye.
There.